This is Fresh Air. I'm David Bianculli, TV critic for the New York Daily News, sitting in for Terry Gross. This week, a PBS concert special paid tribute to Paul Simon, the first recipient of a new award from the Library of Congress. It's the Gershwin Prize for Popular Song, and celebrates both the range and durability of Simon's music, a catalog that spans half a century. Simon's music career began in the 1950s, when he was still in high school. He recorded a hit record with his childhood pal Art Garfunkel, under the name Tom and Jerry. A few years later, they started recording under their own names as Simon and Garfunkel. They became one of the most popular folk-influenced groups of the 60s, recording such hits as Sounds of Silence, Homeward Bound, Mrs. Robinson, and Bridge Over Troubled Water. Simon's gift for catchy melodies and intriguing, unusual lyrics hasn't abandoned him over the years. From Paul Simon's latest album, Surprise, here's his song, Father and Daughter.
Of a second, you can't remember where you are. Just open your window and follow your memory upstream to the meadow in the mountain where we counted every falling star. I believe the light that shines on you will shine. And though I can't guarantee there's nothing scary hiding under your bed, I'm gonna stand guard like a postcard of a golden retriever, and never leave till I leave you with a sweet dream in your you grow, gonna paint a sign so you'll always know, as long as one and one is two, there could never be a father loved his daughter more than I love you.
Terry spoke to Paul Simon in 2000. She asked him about his early days in the music business when he worked for a music publishing company.
It was just when I was coming out of college, and they offered to pay me, I think, $150 a week, which seemed like so much money that I really couldn't refuse it. But I was probably never more miserable than doing that. And my job was to go and take the songs that this huge publishing company owned and go around to record companies and to A&R men at record companies and see if any of their artists wanted to record The Peanut Vendor, or which I think was one of their songs or something like that. And I worked for them for, about 6 months maybe. And I never got one song placed. But I did give them a couple of my songs that I was writing because I felt so guilty about taking their...
Which songs?
Their check. Very early songs, I think, like Bleecker Street. Maybe some songs that weren't even recorded. And then I got into an argument with them. And I said, look, you know, I quit. I'm out of here. I don't want to work here anymore. And I'm not giving you my new song. And see ya. And the song that I had just written was The Sound of Silence. And I said, I'll just publish this myself. And from that point on, I've owned all of my songs. So that was a lucky argument that I had with this guy.
Well, why don't we hear it? And this is Simon and Garfunkel.
Hello, darkness, my old friend. I've come to talk with you again. Because a vision softly creeping left its seeds while I was sleeping. And the vision that was planted in my brain still remains within the sound of silence.
restless dreams I walked alone. Narrow streets of cobblestone. Neath the halo of a street lamp, I turned my collar to the cold and damp. When my eyes were stared by the flash of a neon light that split the night and touched the sound of silence. And in the naked light I saw.
Continuing and talking about your early career in music. I think it was during that era when you were working for the publishing company that you also ended up cutting demos. And this was before there were Simon and Garfunkel hits. Were you doing demos for other singers of how songs should sound?
Yeah, I was doing demos for a long time. The publishing company job, that was only a few months.
Mm-hmm.
That was really an anomaly. But the demos was really how I learned to record. That's how I learned about recording technique. Because I was in the studio several days a week. And for a while, I did a lot of demos with Carole King. And we worked as a team because she could play drums and piano, and I could play guitar and bass. And we could sing the parts and make up background parts and do it pretty quickly. And what it was writers would have a song that they wanted some specific artist to sing, and they'd, you know, give you the song, and you'd try and make it a demo that would appeal to that artist.
So did you learn a lot about craft when you were doing all these demos? Well, not only what it took to make a good song, but then what it took to put a song across on record?
I learned how to record. You know, how you got sounds on a record, and learn to be comfortable in a studio playing, and to, you know, get it relatively quickly in a couple of takes because there wasn't much time. They'd book studios by the hour, and you tried to do two or three songs in an hour because you got paid by the song. So I began to learn, you know, what studios and around town had facilities that maybe I could use, and who was good, and what tricks or whatever information that you would amass by, you know, doing the task over and over again, week after week. And I did that for a few years, like 2 or 3 years, maybe more. And All of that experience was, you know, very useful to me by the time I got up to recording the first album for Columbia, the Simon and Garfunkel first album.
There's a demo that was released on a box set of Bridge Over Troubled Water, you doing the demo
of it.
And I just want to play this because I think it's really interesting to hear you doing the demo version of it. And before we hear it, I'm wondering, is this in a higher key than the actual record is?
Well, I'm not sure what key it is or what key the record is. It's the key that I wrote it on the guitar, and it was too high, so I'm going into falsetto also. I'm not really doing anything other than sketching out a demo, so.
Right.
But I decided somewhere relatively early, I can't remember exactly when, relatively early, that the song should be played with piano, like a gospel song. And I was listening to a lot of gospel music at that time, the Swan Silvertones and the Soul Stirrers and Dixie Hummingbirds. Those were the groups I was listening to.
Mm-hmm.
So I had some idea about a gospel sound that I wanted, and there was a piano. So I knew that the song was going to change to piano, and my instinct was that Artie should sing it. So that's the way it came out.
Mm-hmm. Let's hear your demo version of it. This is Paul Simon.
When you're weary, feeling sad, when peace is all you seek, I will be there. To bring you sleep.
times are hard and pain is all around like a bridge over troubled waters. I would lay me down like a bridge over troubled waters. I would lay me down.
Paul Simon speaking to Terry Gross in 2000. More after a break. This is Fresh Air. Let's get back to Terry's 2000 interview with Paul Simon. She asked if he could remember the first music which really made an impression on him.
My first memory of being taken with a piece of music was, it was a summer day and I was waiting for a Yankee game to come on. And I was listening to the show that preceded the Yankee game. And I was going to score the game, so I was filling out the score, my scorecard, getting ready for the game to begin. And the show was a pop music show, and it was called, I think it was called Make Believe Ballroom. And the disc jockey said, here's a record that they've given to me. He said, this has to be one of the worst records I've ever heard. He said, if this record is a hit, I'll eat my hat. And he played a record called G by the Crows. And I thought, as I was filling out my lineup, that's the first thing I've heard on that show that I thought was decent. I couldn't stand all the rest of it. And it was an R&B record. So that's my first recollection. Then the next thing, of course, was that Alan Freed's show, which was called The Moondog Show, was played on WINS in New York. And what he played was sort of a mix of doo-wop and rhythm and blues, but it also had, in those early days, the Sun Record people, Presley, Perkins, Johnny Cash, and a year or so later, the Everly Brothers. So there was a pretty wide variety of what was then called rock and roll. And I just thought it all belonged together. And soon after that I began to write. I wrote my first song. It was called The Girl For Me. And it was a doo-wop song, and it was sung around. And lots of little groups sang it in the neighborhood. It wasn't just our group. It sort of became famous in a couple of adjacent neighborhoods. In a way, it was like a hit. And then pretty soon after that, I'm talking about age 14 now, but by age 15, I wrote a song with Artie called Hey School Girl. And we went into some studio and made a demo of it. For $5, you could make a recording if you recorded it directly onto acetate and didn't use the tape. $5. And we made that, and there was some guy waiting to use the studio after us who heard it, and he said, I have a record company. I'd like to put that record out. He asked, to call our parents. And he did, and we made our first record, and it was a hit. I mean, it sold like 100,000 copies or something and was in the top 5 or 10 in New York. And I think it got into the top 50 nationally. And that was the first record that we made.
Why did you use the names Tom and Jerry for this record?
We didn't. The record company gave it to us. If you think back to 1957, which you probably, I don't know if you can or you can't, because I don't know how old you are.
I can.
Okay. It was really impossible to use an ethnic name. You couldn't use those names that had any ethnicity. In fact, it was a daring move in 1964 when Columbia Records said, I don't think you guys should be called, I think you should go by your name. I think you should be called Simon and Garfunkel. When that first happened in 1964, there was a lot of, like, is that a law firm kind of jokes? And
A Catskills
so,
act.
Exactly. And so that really what was going on in 1957. That was unheard of that anybody would be entering into pop music from that didn't have Anglo-Saxon name. So the guy who owned the record company gave us the name Tom and Jerry after the cartoon characters.
You've done a lot of investigation of international musics, particularly music of Africa, Latin America. When did you start getting the impulse to listen to music that was that far away from home? I mean, this was before Afropop became, very popular. How were you first exposed to it, and why did you decide to get deeper into it?
I think I was first exposed to it with Alan Freed and what I said earlier. When you mix in into the same half hour something by Carl Perkins and The Moon Glows and Ruth Brown and Ray Charles and Johnny Cash, and you call it all rock and roll, and you say it's all the same because it's called rock and roll. What you're really talking about, or Fats Domino, what you're really talking about is music from Louisiana, which is heavily syncopated and influenced by Caribbean rhythms, which are really West African, and or the Everly's, or Carl Perkins, and that music is, in the Everly's case, that's like that's Appalachian influenced, and so that's coming from a Celtic tradition, and Frankie Lyman and the doo-wop groups, they're coming from a gospel quartet, which is also a mix of African and English, and so very early on, I was exposed to a lot of different cultures. Just nobody explained it that way. Plus, my father was a musician, and he played music from his era, which was probably the big band era. And he often used to play at Roseland Ballroom in New York. And there was another band that would play with him. And it was a Latin band, so I heard Latin music, too.
Tell me more about your father, about what he played, what kind of music.
Well, he played bass, and he played all kinds of music. And it was a generation of musicians that prided themselves on the fact that they could play all kinds of music.
Did his band play for, like, bar mitzvahs and weddings and things like that?
Could do that. The band could play that, or it could play at a dance place like Roseland, or he was on the Arthur Godfrey television show. He was in that band. He made some records. He was on some of the early rock and roll records. Somebody
would
call him up and book him. And he'd play. Really, it was a generation, as I said, that, prided themselves on just put the music in front of me and I can play it. It's whatever it is, there's a familiarity with it, if not, a great expertise. So anyway, my background was, I was exposed to a lot of different music. I wasn't interested in most of it, and I only liked this, certain kinds of rock and roll, but I remembered all of it.
Did you and your father have any music wars, music conflicts? Like a lot of people growing up in the 50s had these big fights in the car, for instance, about who would control the radio. Would you listen to the station that played Papa Loves Mambo and How Much Is That Doggy in the Window, or would you listen to the station that was playing Elvis Presley?
No, we didn't really have any fights about that. He was an easygoing guy. He wasn't going to... He didn't think much of that music.
Of which music?
The music that I liked. Of the music that I liked. He thought it was... He really thought it was really too simple. And... And from his point of view, he was a well-trained musician. It was very simple. harmonically, what wasn't simple was how to actually do it and make it be good. It's easy to mistake something that's simple for having, you know, little value. Actually, it's pretty hard to be simple and good, as I've found out, you know, many times.
Paul Simon speaking to Terry Gross in 2000. He just received the Gershwin Prize for Popular Song from the Library of Congress. I'm David Biancooley, and this is Fresh Air.